Chapter 29 of the Autobiography of Lord Alfred Douglas. This Legamus recording may be distributed and adapted freely for any purpose. Chapter 29. I went back to London after Oscar's death, and lived in rooms in Duke Street, Portland Place, and with my brother Percy in a place called Smedmore in Dorsetshire, which he had taken. My brother Percy, now become Queensbury, inherited no place, except the small house Glen Stuart in Dumfriesshire, which was let to my uncle and aunt, Sir Beaumont and Lady Florence Dixie, and about 2,000 acres. All the rest of the property and the family place, Kinmount, had been sold by my father. Percy inherited, however, about £300,000. Unfortunately, he had already borrowed large sums on his expectations, at exorbitant rates of interest, and nearly half of his inheritance was immediately mopped up by moneylenders. Owing to the quarrel with my father, which took place over the wild business and was never made up, there had been no resettlement of the property. As it is the fashion for the Ross Harris school of wild worshippers to assert that I ruined Oscar Wilde, I may observe that it would, on the same principle, be easy for me to argue that Oscar Wilde not only ruined me, but also ruined my whole family. The Ross Harris argument, reduced to its ultimate form, is that if Wilde had never met me, my father would never have interfered with him, and that in that case he would never have been exposed and ruined. This was, in effect, the essential part of the argument by which the defence in the ransom trial, when I sued for libel, justified their libel and won the case. Following the same line of reasoning, I might say that if I had never met Wilde, I would never have quarrelled with my father and been saved, in plain English, ruined, by him, that my brother Percy, by espousing my cause, would never have become involved in a lifelong feud with my father, and that, but for this feud, there would have been a proper resettlement of the property onto Percy's son, the present Marquis, which would have made it impossible for the property which had been in the Douglas family for so many 100 years to have been alienated from that family for ever. However, this sort of speculation as to what might have been if something else had not happened is fruitless and foolish. Even after Percy had satisfied his rapacious creditors, there would still have been enough money left to him to have at least £6,000 or £7,000 a year, and he might have settled the reversion of this income irrevocably on his elder son, and made provision for the younger children. But, unfortunately for him, he was in the city, and certain city sharks, or as Shylock would say, land rats, got hold of him, and relieved him of all his money in a very short time. Poor Percy was ruined, really, in a way, by his early success in finance. He left the Navy when he was only about 19, and after spending a few years on a ranch in the Western States and in a tea plantation in Ceylon, he went to Australia, accompanied by his great friend, the Honourable David Carnegie, youngest son of Lord Southesk, and made tracks for Perth and the goldfields. David and he, after many adventures, got to the goldfields at the very beginning of the rush. They staked out claims, and Percy returned to London to try to sell them. After he had made all sorts of fruitless attempts in the city to dispose of his and David's properties, the West Australian gold mining boom suddenly came. The result of the boom was that Percy made quite a lot of money, about £20,000 or more. At that time he was Lord Percy Douglas, a younger son with no particular prospects. When my eldest brother Francis, Viscount Drumlanrig, was killed by the accidental explosion of his gun, Percy became the eldest son and heir to a large fortune. Having found it so easy at such an early age to discover gold and to make money, Percy conceived what proved to be the fatal idea that he was destined to be a millionaire. When he became eldest son, he already had plenty of money at his disposal, for, needless to say, he treated the £20,000 or so that he had made not as capital, but as money to spend. He started speculating on a large scale, and raised money on his expectations in order, as he thought, to make a rapid fortune. Unfortunately, he drank a good deal, a habit he acquired in his ranching and gold-digging days, and when he was under the influence of this tendency of his, he was an easy mark for the unscrupulous. Although he really had a great flair for good things, was a good prospector, and over again discovered or originated properties from which other people have made fortunes, he never could protect his own interests. He rediscovered and had in his own possession for several years the Bruce Mines copper mine, which is now one of the largest sources of the wealth of Sir Alfred Mond. In the end he got frozen out, and others reaped where he had sown. I could mention half a dozen similar cases. The late Alan Stoneham, who died an exceedingly rich man, benefited enormously by my brother's good things, beginning with the properties in Western Australia to which I have referred. Poor old Percy was recklessly generous, confiding and extravagant. In certain moods he would almost literally throw money out of the window. On one occasion we went down the embankment on a bitterly cold night and distributed nearly £1,000 in banknotes to the men and women down and out who were spending the night on the seats there. He had an enormous number of friends of all classes all over the world, and at his funeral, which took place in the Catholic Cathedral at Westminster in 1920, hundreds of people who were unknown to his family turned up to pay a last tribute to him. At the same time, it cannot be denied that his accession to the position of eldest son by the untimely death of my dear brother Francis was the cause of the debacle of the family fortunes, which his son, my nephew, the present Marquis, has already done much to repair. I had a good time with Percy at Smedmore, where the shooting was good, and still more so at Colonsay, a beautiful island in the Hebrides, which he took for a year. Colonsay consisted of about 12 to 14,000 acres. There was a charming house and plenty of coverts for pheasants, a very unusual thing in these islands, which are generally bare of trees. The bag was a really good all-round one, for in addition to a not very good grouse moor, there were several hundred brace of partridges to be shot, at least 500 woodcock, and any quantity of duck and snipe. I myself, with one other gun, an Argyllshire laird called Graham, in the month of February 1902, shot 147 woodcock there in 5 days shooting, when there was a hard frost on the mainland, which did not reach the islands, and sent in swarms of woodcock. If we had had two more guns, we could have shot double the number during the days that the frost lasted. Just before this time, in October 1901, I went over to the United States. I still had my horses at Chantilly, but my financial position was distinctly rocky. When I came into my money at my father's death, I regret to say that it never occurred to me for a moment that I could live on the interest of my capital, which would have been about £600 or £700 a year, more than I have got now. I spent the money freely, having fully decided, though I blush to have to say so, that before it was all gone I would marry an American heiress. In pursuance of this noble ambition, I scraped together about £800 and went off to New York, armed with a few letters of introduction, including a letter, not of introduction because I already knew him, from my uncle Percy Wyndham to his nephew and namesake, my cousin Percy Wyndham, son of Sir Hugh Wyndham, who was second secretary at the British Embassy in Washington. I must say honestly that there would have been no difficulty at all about the heiress. I might have had the choice between at least three, one of whom had quite £20,000 a year. But, unfortunately for the success of my scheme, I had fallen in love before I left for America with a lady who is now my wife, Olive Custance. When I left England in search of an heiress, although I was already very devoted to Olive, I did not think that I had the slightest chance of marrying her. We met in a romantic way, for it was started by Olive, who was a distinguished poet. Her book, Opals, had then been published by John Lane about a year before, writing to me expressing admiration for my poetry. I replied in suitable terms, and it was not long before we met. We fell in love at sight. Who ever loved that loved not at first sight? and thanks to the good-natured assistance of Olive's cousin, the lovely Lily, Marchioness of Anglesey, now Mrs. John Gilliatt, we met every day for about 10 days in Paris, where Olive was staying then with Lady Anglesey and other friends at a hotel in the Champs-Élysées. Olive and I had already on several occasions met surreptitiously in London. She came to see me the first time, chaperoned by her maid, in my rooms at Duke Street after we had made an appointment at the South Kensington Museum, which, owing to my going to the wrong door, or the wrong room, I forget which, had failed to bring about a meeting. We were both very shy, but the romance ripened rapidly. Olive introduced me to her mother, Mrs. Custance, and on that occasion, at an hotel in Dover Street, we made the exciting discovery that we had met before at the wedding of my cousin, Rachel Montgomery, to the Reverend Reginald Knatchbull Hugerson at Trinity Church, Sloane Square, and afterwards at the house of my Uncle Alexander and Aunt Rose, Sir Alexander and Lady Montgomery, at 56 Cadogan Place. On that occasion I was still in Eton jackets, and little Olive was a 10-year-old bridesmaid. Neither of us remembered the meeting, but obviously we had met on that occasion. Shortly afterwards, Olive wrote from Dinard to say that she and Lily Anglesey, with whom she was staying, were going on to Paris, and that if the Prince, that was me, would come over, he could meet his page, herself, as often as he wished to do so. Needless to say, I at once went to Paris to the Hotel Restat, Rue d'Orneau, where we afterwards spent our honeymoon. For the next 10 days I saw Olive every day, at meals, at Lily's hotel, a separate table, for the children, was provided. And we also went out by ourselves to lunch and dinner at restaurants, and spent a day at Chantilly, looking at my horses and wandering in the forest, holding each other's hands. And all our talk was delicate and shy, to quote one of Olive's poems, written a month or two later. Then I went off to America, very much depressed. No question of marriage with Olive had arisen. I had no money, and it appeared utterly unthinkable that we could ever marry. But when I got to New York, Olive wrote to me often, and I replied, and the heiresses began to appear less and less attractive the more I saw and heard of them. I must explain that I never got to the stage of making up to any one particular heiress. All that happened was that I had reliable information, in 2 cases it was actually in their own writing, that I would not be rejected if I chose to proceed. All this sounds rather sordid, but this is a true story, and I am not concealing anything. After a month or 6 weeks in New York, and a week or two in Boston, in both of which places I had an agreeable time and met pleasant people, I went on to Washington. I landed up at an hotel there, and my cousin, Percy Wyndham, who had heard from our joint uncle Percy that I was coming, came to see me. He treated me with the greatest kindness and hospitality. The ambassador, Lord Pauncefoot, left a card at my hotel. I returned his call, and next day Percy Wyndham came to see me and invited me to leave the hotel and come to his rooms as his guest. I accepted and went, and for about 3 weeks I enjoyed a most cheerful and lively time and met, and was entertained by, a number of charming people. Percy made me an honorary member of the Metropolitan Club, I think that was the name, which was, I believe, by way of being the smart club of Washington. Then, after about a fortnight, some charming person or other at the club raised a question about my being an honorary member, in view of my connection with a disgraceful scandal. I strolled into the club one day and ordered a drink, when a man, unknown to me and whose name I do not know, who was sitting with a group of members, made an offensive remark about Oscar Wilde in a loud voice, evidently intending that I should hear. Like the young lady of Sweden, when they cried Whedon Station, I made no observation, but finished my drink and went back to my cousin's rooms. There I found that my cousin Percy had received a letter from the committee of the club, asking for an explanation of the fact that he had introduced me as a member. Percy Wyndham replied that no explanation was required, that I was his cousin and guest, a man of high social position, that I was on intimate terms with the British ambassador and Lady Paunceford, that I was a member of one of the most exclusive clubs in London, and that he had no doubt that in view of the attitude adopted by the committee of the Metropolitan Club, I would be extremely unlikely to have any desire to go into their club again. As this was quite unanswerable, the committee wisely refrained from making any answer, and there the matter ended, except that the newspapers got hold of the story. In other words, it was deliberately given to them by one or more members of the club. The New York Herald came out with headlines, and the other papers followed suit. I was at that time frightfully sensitive to anything of the kind, and I told my cousin that I should leave Washington at once. He'd begged me not to go. The naval attaché asked me to lunch, and all the rest of the embassy staff rallied round. Lord Paunceford sent for me and told me that the Metropolitan Club was a pothouse of the deepest dye, that the members never lost a chance of being rude to anyone who was on friendly terms with the British Embassy or himself, and that it was beneath my dignity to take the slightest notice of them. He then told me that Lady Paunceford was expecting me to dinner next day to meet someone or other. I forget who it was, but I rather fancy it was Mr. Choate, and that she wanted me to take her to a concert that afternoon. I went to the concert with Lady Paunceford and attended her dinner party, but after that I felt I could not stand it any longer. The whole thing got on my nerves. I was bitterly hurt and disappointed. I felt instinctively that my cousin, though he begged me to stay on, really would be delighted to get rid of me. Subsequent events proved that I was right in my conjecture, and I insisted on going back to New York. I must say that my cousin behaved quite correctly, as well as kindly and generously. I really think he liked me, and enjoyed having me to stay with him. He was a delightful person, and had a great sense of humour and a very kind heart, and we had much in common. Up till the time when the incident of the club occurred, we had got on splendidly. But there never has been a diplomat yet who, with one eye on the Foreign Office in London, has not got cold shivers at the idea of any kind of newspaper scandal. He could not, being an Englishman, have been expected to do more than he did, and dear old Lord Paunceford and Lady Paunceford were kindness itself. It was just one of the numerous occasions on which I have had to pay for having been associated with Oscar Wilde. 3 days after I got back to New York, an invitation to dine with Senator Cabot Lodge, who I understand was considered rather an important person, was forwarded on to me. No doubt if I had stayed at Washington a little longer, many people at Washington, besides the embassy, would have made a point of being kind to me, but my lacerated feelings did not allow me to take any chances of further snubs. I remained in New York, where I was made an honorary member of the University Club, for another fortnight. I wrote a long letter, which appeared in the New York Herald, giving my version of the Metropolitan Club incident, and I then left for England. I also, as I have just remembered, wrote a not very good sonnet, which was published in the New York Herald, in which I let out at America generally. Since then, I have been more abused and blackguarded and libelled and insulted and lied about in America, for no reason at all and without the slightest provocation, but I imagine chiefly by the admirers of Wilde and what he stands for, than I have been in all the other parts of the globe put together, which is saying a good deal. It does not worry me at all, and individual Americans whom I have met from time to time have invariably got on famously with me, as I have with them. The people who abuse me in America have never met me, and necessarily they know nothing whatever about me, except what Mr. Frank Harris has told them. Consequently, it is not surprising that they do not like me. It would be absurd for me to resent the fact that the caricature of my real self, which is all they know of me, does not appeal to them. End of chapter 29.